Thank you. Thank you very much. It's a real pleasure to be invited to come and see you. And I've had a wonderful day looking around some of the labs and talking to people and discovering the range of things that are going on here. Today I want to talk about whether the electron is round or not. And the reason I want to do that is because we've been conducting an experiment for rather a long time, actually. It's about 15 years since we first dreamed this up. But now it works, and that's really why I want to talk about it. So let me first of all just begin by saying a few words about the motivation for this. For those of you who are expert, I have another title that might make you happier, which is the search for the electron's electric dipole moment, but that is actually just the same as is the electron round. Now, the first thing I want to get out of the way is this question about the point. Many people say the electron is a point particle. So what are you talking about? How can it have a shape? And so I want to discuss that right away. The electron is in some mathematical way may well be a point, but the electrons that I look at in my lab are living in the actual world full of quantum fluctuations of the vacuum, right? When I just see what's here, I pump all the gas out of empty space, there's still fluctuating fields, light fields and particle fields. So the electron, it may be a point in a mathematical sense, but it's just inevitably surrounded by a big ball of fluff made up of all of the vacuum fluctuations of all of the particles and fields that exist in nature. It's just dressed by this stuff in exactly the same way that an electron inside a material is living in the material. And as it moves around in the lattice or whatever, its mass is the mass that it gets by the fact that it's the electron plus all the stuff around it. So the electron that I'm talking about is not the point electron of the mathematician. It's the electron as it actually is in the wild, living in its real environment. Now, a big part of 20th century physics was to address exactly this question. How does electricity and magnetism and charges work? How can the electron possibly pack all that charge into a point? And they did, and it was in the course of thinking about these questions and how quantum mechanics works that it was realized that there are electrons and their antiparticles, positrons, and that light fields can even break up into electrons and positrons. And that these things, the light and the electrons and the positrons, are able to flicker in and out of existence, to fluctuate in the vacuum. And so the negative charge here is surrounded by these virtual electrons and positrons, and you may not be able to see it, but I've got some little pluses here to indicate that the vacuum can be polarized so the electron can attract some positive charges towards it. And of course it will repel some of the virtual negative particles as well so that the total charge is still one electron, but now there's a distribution of charge. So this is very deep in the way that quantum electrodynamics works. And this was the subject for which, you know, Schwinger and Feynman and all Tominaga and those people got their Nobel prizes, was understanding how this works. So the point electron is just coupled inevitably to this polarizable vacuum. And if you look at shorter and shorter distances, you'll see that there's a role not only for the electrons and the positrons, but for all of the leptons and antileptons and quarks and antiquarks and the Higgs particle and whatever is in the standard model. But moreover, the vacuum is whatever it is. So if there are other particles, we don't know what they are, but they're there. They're there in their vacuum state. If they're not actually being made in CERN, they're still there in their vacuum fluctuations. So there's other stuff, probably. If you think there are new particles, they'll be fluctuating around the electron, and the electron will be coupled to them. Now, the electron has a spin, so that defines a direction, and it doesn't take a huge imagination to think that the charge, the positive charges that are attracted towards it might also be displaced along the spin direction. So that although the charge is just the charge of the electron in total, it now has a non-spherical distribution. In this case, what I've drawn is that the plus part is displaced towards the tip of the arrow compared with the minus part. And that's what we mean by an electric dipole moment, and it's what I mean by the electron being not round. So our experiment is aimed at detecting whether this describes what an electron is really like. Is there a displacement of positive charge along the spin direction in the electron? One reason it's an interesting question is if you think about taking a movie of this thing and running it backwards, what would you see? Well, you would see the charges would just be in the same place, but the sense of rotation of the electron would go the other way around in the backwards movie. So the arrow that represents that would point down instead of up. And now you see that the electron on the right is simply not the same as the electron on the left. I can make their spins point the same way by turning it around, but then their dipole moments would be opposite. So they're just different electrons. Could it be that nature just chooses one of them? So if our experiment measures and finds a dipole moment on the electron, that seems to suggest that nature would be choosing one of these over the other one. Ah, you say, maybe what it is that some electrons are like this and some electrons are like that. But if that were true, then when you looked at the shell structure of atoms, you'd be able to make lithium atoms with three electrons in the ground state. The whole periodic table of the elements would go wrong. So my feeling is there is only one kind of electron. And if it has a dipole moment, then it's because nature is breaking time reversal symmetry. People call this time reversal symmetry. It really just means motion going backwards. Is it possible that nature breaks time reversal symmetry? Well, it's slightly unpleasant, but yes, it's perfectly possible. In fact, we already know of some interactions in the kaon system in particle physics that do that. But they're not able to induce a dipole moment in the electron of big enough to see. I'll tell you about that in a moment. So what's the big deal about breaking time reversal symmetry? Well, the biggest deal, I think, about it is this. A big class of theories, relativistic quantum field theories that are local, have a theorem, a rule, that if you break time reversal symmetry in any such theory, you've got to break CP symmetry. C means charge conjugation, particles turning into antiparticles. P means parity. It means essentially looking in the mirror, inverting space. So breaking CP symmetry is a very interesting thing to think about because it probably is required to explain why the universe is made of matter. There's a famous argument, many of you will know, by the Russian physicist Sakharov, who realized that if in the Big Bang equal amounts of matter and antimatter were produced, then somehow that symmetry had to be broken if nowadays we're just made of matter and the antimatter's vanished. The rules for the antimatter must have been different from the rules for the matter. And that's just another way of saying that something in nature must have violated CP symmetry. And if CP symmetry is violated, then probably T symmetry is violated. And if T-symmetry is violated, then you may be able to see that in the dipole moment of the electron. So there's a kind of a complicated chain of argument, but I find it rather pleasing that the study of something as small as the electron can tell you something about a thing as big as the universe. Why are we here? Well, let's look at the electron, and that will give us some insight into that question. Okay, if you're going to measure something, it's a good idea. I mean, you're going to measure something and you don't know how big it is. That's why you want to measure it. It's a good idea to get the advice of a theorist. You don't believe it, but it's a good idea to ask. And then you can have some sensible design for your experiment. So let's ask the theorist, how big is the electric dipole moment of the electron? And the theorist knows how to compute stuff using the standard model. The standard model contains the various particles and fields that we know about. And it turns out that in the standard model, the dipole moment of the electron is very small. So that's why I've put it right down at the bottom of this logarithmic graph, because it's very small. The units are e centimeters. E is the charge of the electron, and centimeters are centimeters. So it means that if you think about a charge e within the electron, that plus, how far is it displaced? Well, according to the standard model, about 10 to the minus 38 centimeters. Nobody has the foggiest idea how to measure something so small. It might as well be zero. However, people worrying about what physics there is beyond the Standard Model. What new things do we need to invent, for example, to explain this matter-antimatter asymmetry? Those people have a whole load of theories that I've listed a few suggestive ones up here. And they like theories that predict a dipole moment usually in this sort of range up here, 10 to the minus 24 down to about 10 to the minus 30. That is not to say that you can't come up with a theory that makes a dipole moment smaller or bigger. But right now, the majority of theories that are trying to understand what's going on at the kind of energy scales that we think we know something about, just a bit above the LHC, those theories are predicting values up here. So that makes this an interesting range to study. Now I want to make a short remark, which will only make sense to the specialists, but I think it's worth making. This here refers to a particularly simple variant of the supersymmetry scenario. And what I want to say is that the dipole moment of the electron in this kind of setup comes in the first instance from a very, very simple diagram. This is exactly like the diagram that gives you the G minus 2 correction to the magnetic moment of the electron, right? The electron can sometimes emit a photon and reabsorb it. Here, the electron is emitting a supersymmetric electron, a selectron, and this is the Gugino going along here. Then it reabsorbs it, and this simple one-loop radiative correction gives you a dipole moment, and it's huge. It's this big. It's 10 to the minus 24, and it depends on these various... Some of you who know what's written on Julian Schwinger's grave will recognize alpha over pi. It's what you get with a one-loop radiative correction. And then the masses come in, that's the mass of the electron and the mass of the supersymmetric partner. And this phase here is a phase you need to break the CP symmetry. So it's a very simple thing, and if I just say, well, I don't know what the phase is, so it's about one. And I don't know what the mass of this electron is, but it's a 1 or 2 or 3 TeV. And I do know the mass of the electron. Well, that gives you an EDM up here. So it's an interesting range to study. And our experiment is designed to investigate this range. The middle of the range is, let's say, somewhere around about 10 to the minus 27 is the middle of the range, 5 times 10 to the minus 28 here. Suppose we design an experiment to measure that. Immediately, a moment's thought about your experiment, and you'll come up with what I call the magnetic moment problem. So here's the experiment. We have an electron. It's got a dipole this big. I'm going to measure the interaction of that with an electric field. So the interaction energy is just d dot e. D dot e, I can divide it by Planck's constant to get a frequency. So atomic physicists, spectroscopists like to express energies as frequencies. So it's a nanohertz. That's what we want to measure as a nanohertz. But there's a practical problem. What if in my lab there was a little bit of magnetic field? I mean, actually, there's normally, you know, half a gauss or whatever from the Earth. Well, okay, I can control that. I put the shield around my experiment. But the question is, how small must I make the magnetic field to get the interaction, magnetic interaction, mu dot b, let's say at least equal to this, if not smaller than this? And the answer is 1 femtogauss. So now I know who the experimenters are because they immediately start laughing at me. And for the theorists, let me say, this is very small. So that's a serious problem. You can't dream up an experiment with this kind of requirement. Well, nobody knows how to do it with this kind of requirement on the stray magnetic field. And the solution to this was first proposed in the 1960s by Sanders. And he realized the following. If the electron is contained within an atom or a molecule, then the dipole moment of the atom or the molecule can actually be much bigger than the dipole moment of the electron. So suppose I have a molecule, because inside an atom or a molecule, it's very common for the spins of the electrons to be paired up. But if you pick one where there's an unpaired electron, so there's a dipole moment that's not cancelled by another electron, that dipole moment can polarize the molecule or atom. And because the molecule or atom is a floppy thing, it can actually be given a bigger dipole than the one that's doing the inducing that sits on the electron. That's the idea. And so now the interaction energy, I can write it down like this. It's the product of this induced dipole moment times the electric field. So it's here. And I want to group the amplification factor, eta, and the field, E, together to say the same thing, but just from a slightly different perspective. So now you imagine you're the electron sitting inside the molecule, and I apply a field, E, on the molecule. What does the electron see? It doesn't see the field, E. It sees the field, E, amplified by all the surrounding electrons and nuclei that constitute the molecule. So the molecule, from this perspective, is an amplifier which amplifies the field that I've applied. So that's the idea of Sanders. And in our experiment, as I will show you, what we measure is not the dipole moment of the electron, but the dipole moment associated with a molecule. So to get from what we measure to back to a value for the electron, I'm going to need somebody to tell me what this eta is. And that somebody is going to be a quantum chemist who knows how to compute this effect in a big complicated system with a lot of electrons in it. And so let me just say a word about it. This amplified field has two bits. One bit I've called F. It depends on the structure of the atom or molecule. It depends what particular, how floppy it is. And unexpectedly, until you think about it, it also depends on the cube of some heavy nucleus inside this thing. And the reason is, without relativity, there's no enhancement, it turns out. So this eta is actually zero unless the electron is moving relativistically. And the way to get an electron to move relativistically is put it close to a very heavy nucleus so that it's going around really fast. And so that's why this cube of the charge Z, of the charge number Z, comes in. So you need a heavy atom or molecule to get this effect. And what's P? P is very simple. It's just the electric polarization. So before I finish this slide, I want to talk about the polarizer, how things get polarized. So an atom, of course, is round, like 1s. Hydrogen ground state is 1s. When I apply an electric field, it gets to be stretched by the electric field. And if we think about the quantum mechanics of that, we have to mix in to the 1s state some p state. The nearest one is the 2p state. And in perturbation theory, you'll know that the amount of 2p state that you mix in has an energy denominator. The further away in energy that 2p state is, the bigger the energy denominator is, the smaller the mixing is. And that translates into saying that the further apart the ground state and the first excited state are, the stiffer the atom is and the harder it is to polarize it. So I put my electric field on, and if it's a hydrogen atom, it doesn't have much polarization. And so this P is very small. Now, by contrast, let's think about a polar molecule. A polar molecule is, let's take a dumbbell. So there's an atom here and an atom here, and one of them has given a charge to the other ones. There's a plus and a minus here. This is what a chemist would call a dipole moment. It's pointing along the internuclear axis. That's not the dipole moment I want to measure. This dipole moment does not violate any fundamental symmetries. But it's within the molecule. Normally, the way a molecule sits is it's kind of pointing in all directions at once because it has a rotational state. When I apply the electric field, how can I line up the dumbbell? It's the same story. The lowest rotational state is a rotational quantum number of zero, and then there's a rotational quantum number of one. And to line up the molecule, I just have to mix those two states. And what's the energy denominator? It's just the rotational splitting. And that's 10 gigahertz, whereas in the atom, the splitting of the first electronic excitation is 10 to the 15 hertz. It's a million times further away. So I can polarize a polar molecule by simply lining it up with the electric field. So a molecule is more attractive then because this enhancement is going to be much bigger because of the fact that the molecule is more easily polarized. We use a molecule called ytterbium fluoride. Ytterbium is a heavy metal, and it binds by sending an electron from one side to the other. So it has a big chemistry dipole moment. That makes it polarizable. And how big is the enhancement factor? Well, here we are. I apply a field in kilovolts, and I get an effective field, an amplified field, in gigavolts per centimeter. So in fact, we apply 10 kilovolts per centimeter, and we get 15 gigavolts per centimeter. So a million times more field than we apply is what the electron feels. Now, let's remember the problem. The problem was that we're trying to measure a nanohertz of interaction energy, and then it's impossible to control the magnetic stuff at that level. But now we've just had a magnification of a million, so it's not a nanohertz anymore, it's a millihertz. And now you see what magnetic field you need is only a nanogauss. And we can control the field at that level. So that's the absolutely key step that we try to do this measurement using the amplification that is given to us by a heavy polar molecule. Now, how does it actually work? On the left here, I have a molecular beam source. Chemists will know this. This is just a super standard type supersonic jet beam source. That thing is exactly like, I mean, it's not just like, it is exactly the little valve that injects fuel into the engine of your car. Every so often you need to puff a little bit of petrol and air mixture into the cylinder of your car, and the valve opens up and out comes a puff of stuff which makes the car run. For making molecular beams, that's just what you want. So there's some gas here, and every so often we open the valve and a puff of gas comes out. And then over here is some gubbins that I won't discuss, but it allows us to put ytterbium fluoride molecules into this puff of gas. Then the puff of gas expands and cools. And the amazing thing is it starts out at room temperature here. In this pipe, it's at room temperature. And when it rushes out of the hole, it cools to about 3 Kelvin. And it cools the YBF as well as the carrier gas, which is argon in our case. And so there are pulses of molecules flying down the beam line here. And every time that pulse of molecules flies through this laser beam, some of the laser light is scattered by the molecules into this detector, and we see a pulse of signal. And this pulse of signal depends upon exciting the molecules from a very specific state, because the laser has a very specific frequency. So it only excites these molecules when they're in a particular state. So we have a state-selective detection scheme, and the height of the pulse tells us how many molecules are in that state. There's another laser here, and the molecules fly through this first laser, and then they're subjected to a radio frequency pulse, and I won't explain what this is doing, but just to say, what it does is to line up the spin of the molecule, which is coming from the spin of the unpaired electron, and it lines it up in this direction, which is perpendicular to an electric field made by these yellow plates. So there's some high voltage, there's our 10 kilovolts per centimeter going up and down, and the spin is perpendicular to that. Let there be a dipole moment. We're measuring to see whether there is or not, but suppose there is one. You know that there will be a torque D cross E. It's the way that a dipole interacts with a field, and that will make the spin process. So as the molecules fly along here, the spin direction changes if there's a dipole moment, a change in proportion to how strong the dipole moment is. So if I could measure this precession angle, then I would know how big the dipole is. So we need a way to measure this precession angle, and that's easily done by another RF pulse and detection. As the precession angle changes, so does the height of this signal. It's because the signal can sense the internal workings of the molecule. So the height of this goes up and down as the spin goes round and round. And it's easy to make the spin go round and round. I can just apply a magnetic field, which is what we were discussing before. So let me intentionally put on a magnetic field, and that'll make the spin go round. And the more the field is, this is the strength of the field, if I increase the field from zero along this way, you see my signal goes up and down and up and down, and that's just measuring the spin doing this as the beam goes along through the field. So this is a kind of spin polarimeter, if you like, but we also like to think of it as an interferometer. So I call these interferometer fringes. It's a spin interferometer, and the height of the signal is measuring this rotation angle phi that the spin has undergone as a result of interacting with the fields. So now I can tell you how it all works. Imagine that we have an electric field, and we scan the magnetic field, and we stop when we get here, This is a small magnetic field which parks my experiment on the most sensitive place on this interferometer fringe, the steepest place. I'm going to sit here, and the angle that the spin rotates by is given by this. So mu times b is the interaction, and here's how long it lasted. And d times the amplified field is the electric bit, times how long it lasted. So there are two angles, the magnetic one and the one that I'm interested in coming from the dipole. Now if I reverse the electric field, the sign here will change, so that plus electric bit will become minus electric bit. And so you can see the whole fringe pattern will move across. And if I look at how high my signal is then, when I reverse the electric field, it will go from the red curve to the green curve, the signal will go up. So the experiment is very simple. I just flip the electric field and look for the signal to go up and down. Any experimenter will know that this is too simple. For example, suppose something is drifting always in the same direction, so then which affects my signal, is making my signal get smaller as the day goes by. So the first pulse will always be bigger than the second, and the second then will be bigger than the third, and so forth. So when I take the differences, I might get fooled. This might not be a dipole moment at all. It might just be a drift of my apparatus. One way to suppress that is to hop over to the other side here with minus B. So now I have four operating points, plus and minus E, and plus and minus B. And if you think about it, you'll see that if I take those four signals and I add when the fields are parallel, either this way or this way, and I subtract when they're anti-parallel, like that or like that, what will come out is the bit proportional to the dipole moment, the bit proportional to dE. It's because it goes up on this side and down on this side. So that's a good way of getting rid of drifts, is to switch them both. And the piece of signal that is proportional to the dipole moment is the piece that has the symmetry of E dot B. And for the specialists, let me point out that the symmetry of E dot B is time reversal odd and parity odd. That is exactly the character of a dipole moment. That's why the signature is the E dot B symmetry. So here's a nice kind of theoretical view of what's in the experiment with all of the boring bits removed. We have here the spin interferometer and the signal. That's the thing coming out of my photomultiplier. And two switches, E and B, that I've told you about. I can flip E and B. As it turns out, it's rather useful to have more than just two switches. So we have nine switches, and I'm not going to tell you in detail what they all are. They're just various things that we're able to modulate. And by doing so, they can tell us something about how the experiment is working. When you're trying to measure something very small, your biggest worry is that you make a mistake because of some other effect that you didn't have under control. It looks like your signal, but it isn't. So that's what these other switches are helping us with. You'll easily work out that if you have nine switches, then you can have 512 different arrangements of the experiment. So when we run the experiment, we actually run it in all 512 different configurations. And then our signal is a list of 512 numbers. And what we do, if we wanted to know the dipole moment, we would add when the fields are parallel and subtract when they're anti-parallel, and we'd ignore all the other switches. And we call that the signal that has the E dot B correlation. You can think of more complicated things. So instead of just E dot B, you might ask E dot B dot laser frequency, for example, or the product of all nine of them. If you ask yourself how many of these different correlations can you construct, you'll find that's also 512 of them. So out of this set of 512 numbers, I can actually extract 512 independent bits of information about how the machine works. You will recognize this, it's a generalization of the idea of phase-sensitive detection. So phase-sensitive detection is you have a signal under your control and you want to measure it, and under your control means you can flip it. And then you have a box of electronics which measures a signal, and every time it's up, every time your signal is up, you add, and when it's down, you subtract. And this way, you suppress the background, and you just get the signal. That's exactly what we're doing, except with a lot of different waveforms, extracting a lot of signals simultaneously. Okay, now the last thing I want to comment on about here is, although that this thing the E dot B correlation is the one we want to know about that's telling us the dipole moment. It's actually the one that I don't really want to look at for a period of about 6 years, we didn't look at it. And the reason is because how do you know an experiment's done? Well, you say, I've understood everything. There are no systematic errors. I'm ready. And the difficulty is you must not do that conditional upon the answer that you have. So if you're measuring a thing, you must not decide that you've understood everything on the basis of the answer for how big that thing is. So don't look at the dipole moment signal. Even though we don't know what to expect, we don't want to be biased. Mainly, we don't want to be biased into deciding when to stop and publish the answer. So we've asked the computer, any time we request the value of the E dot B correlation, the value of the EDM signal, please add a constant. It'll be the same constant every time, but don't tell us what it is. So only the computer knows, and we can't tell how big our EDM is. We can see whether we change it by doing things, but we can't see how big it is. If you don't think this is important, then you should read this article in the American Journal of Physics by Zheng, volume 74. Something funny about this, isn't it? Anyway, Zheng in 2006 in American Journal of Physics. It's a wonderful account of how many significant experiments of measuring things accurately have screwed up royally because they didn't follow this advice. So do follow this advice if you measure something carefully. So in 2011, we took a lot of data, 6,194 measurements of the electric dipole moment of the electron. Each was about 6 minutes. Each measurement has its own error bar because we can study the fluctuation of the answer within a single measurement. It's too much to fit on the slide, so I have to roll it along like this. But eventually, we decided we had enough data. I'm not going to go to the... 25 million beam shots. And over again, we put the machine through the 512 different states. And an interesting thing to worry about is what's the statistical distribution of the answer? You know, if you have a single parent distribution, a Gaussian random noise parent distribution for your measurement, if you plot the histogram of the answer normalized by its error bar, you should get a Gaussian of width 1. This is a Gaussian of width 1, this blue line. And here's the histogram of what we actually got. So what you see is it doesn't have a single parent distribution. And the most notable thing is it's got more stuff in the wings than Gauss would tell you, and correspondingly less in the middle. What does that mean? Well, it just means the noise isn't random. And once we realized this, we actually looked at a number of other experiments in my lab, and we discovered that this is more or less true of everything that we do, and I suspect it may be true of everything that you do. Why is it relevant? Well, as undergraduates, we were trained in the black art of adding the square root of the sum of the squares and all that. And it's just to say, it's not exactly right. It doesn't make a big difference. In this experiment, don't let me mislead you, it's not making a big difference. But on the other hand, a person wants to know, what is the meaning of your error bar, right? So one way is to say the meaning of my error bar is I took the square root of the sum of the squares. But another way would be to say I have this level of confidence about my answer, and that's what we wanted to do. At first we were dismayed by this because we didn't know what to do. But it turns out that statisticians know the best way to estimate the probability distribution when you have a big sample like this by using the distribution itself, by using the results themselves. So it's called the bootstrap method, and that's what we do with our data. We use the data to tell us what the parent distribution is, and that allows us to assign the confidence levels to the measurement. So before I tell you the answer and say what the EDM is, let me say a word about the 511 other correlations. At the end of somewhere between 5 and 6 years, we had mastered them all. So most of them are supposed to be zero, and in the beginning, most of them were not zero, and we understood why, and were able to make the machine conform more exactly to our original ideal concept. Experimenters know that the thing you build is very far from the thing you imagine you're building, and you have to discover the difference as you go along. So some of them are not supposed to be. Here are the ones that differ by 5 standard deviations or more from zero. This one calibrates the slope of the fringe. Well, so it's good that that's not zero, because we'd have no sensitivity if it was zero. This is the beam intensity, same applies. But here's a nice example. I don't know if you remember, but when we do the experiment, we have 2 radio frequency pulses. And for diagnostic purposes, it's useful for us to be able to change the phase of the second pulse relative to the first pulse. So we flip this phase, so I'm calling it the phi switch, and it's supposed to just change the phase. And what the molecules are telling us here is, hang on, you didn't just change the phase, you actually slightly changed the amplitude as well. Now, when we built the box of electronics that does this, of course, we looked at it with test equipment to make sure that we were not changing the amplitude, and we couldn't see any change in amplitude. But the molecules are sensitive enough to tell us that actually we were changing the amplitude. And so the machine has signaled up a thing that's not perfect. And then we can think about, what's the consequence of that imperfection? Does it lead to a possible systematic error in the experiment? And we allow this to stand because we don't believe it causes a problem, but it's crucial that we know about it. And similarly, this is telling us something about how the electric field drifts in time, how when we reverse it, it doesn't reverse quite perfectly. And this is an independent measurement of the same thing, the same fact, and so on. So this method of looking at all these signals is very helpful for debugging and understanding the machine. And as I say, all the rest are zero, as they should be. And so now we remove the blind and ask, what is the EDM? So here's the status of what's been published. Prior to our experiment, the best result came from thallium atoms, from a beam of thallium atoms. And as I told you a while back, an atom is not particularly polarizable compared with a molecule. So it has an enhancement factor, but it's nowhere near as big as the enhancement factor we get in our YBF molecule. For this reason, the thallium experiment is really, really hard. And also, I don't have time to explain, but it has a type of systematic error which is huge, and it doesn't happen in the molecule. So for these 2 reasons, the enhancement is small and the systematic errors are big, this experiment was really, really hard. And the last factor of 2 took 10 years, so the student's PhD took 10 years because his job was to get the last factor of 2. I think there will never be another atomic beam experiment to measure this dipole moment for this reason. So this was their result. And our result is this. So we have a central value. We have a statistical error, which is here. And then we have a systematic error, which is here. And when we combine everything together, we know that with 90% confidence, the dipole moment of the electron is less than 1 times 10 to the minus 27, whereas previously it was less than 2 times 10 to the minus 27. So you think, good grief, has he been talking to me for all this time and he's got a miserable factor of 2? Well, the reason I think this is very exciting is because this is the first result of a new method. It's a new era. The other thing is the last gasp. Brilliant tour de force, but the last gasp. So this is really looking forward to what we think we will be able to do.
Excuse me, I have a question. I'm a theory guy, but still I didn't understand the enhancement factor.
Right.
Do you take it from calculations or do you
No, we take it from calculations and they're hard. They're quantum chemist calculations. They're quantum many body couple cluster and Dirac. Sorry? 10%. Yeah, they're getting better. Yeah, pretty confident. They calculate everything. So it's a long. We could have a long discussion about this, but the short answer is it's a really technical, specialized topic. But there are a lot of real experts working independently, and I think 10% is where we are. Okay. So that's the story, and I want to just say that the systematic errors are actually limited by statistical noise because they come from the things that we measure. So when the statistical noise gets better, we'll be able to measure all these bad effects more accurately, and therefore we'll be able to cope with the systematics better. So to do better, we need to get less statistical noise. Here's where we are now. So this is the excluded region. And, you know, on this graph, that factor of 2 that we got hardly shows. The excluded region was already there. Those of us who work in the EDM business long had the feeling that it was really hard for MSSM to survive this critical test of the electric dipole moment of the electron. And now, with results from CERN, I think this is quite a widely held view now that the MSSM is in trouble. But of course, theorists being theorists, there's plenty of wriggle room to make it smaller. We're probing the energy, what's going on at energies of order 1, 2, 3, 4 TeV. That's where we are. So in the last few minutes, I want to say a bit about the future. We're starting to explore this region, or we are currently exploring this region, and I'd like to just say what I see as the program for getting from this dashed line down to another dashed line, which will be at the bottom. How we will improve. So there are 3 phases. Phase 1 going on now, small upgrades, and it's giving us about a factor of 3 improvement, I think probably this year. Phase 2 is a new source, right? In particle physics, it's a new accelerator. Many good things happen when you get a new accelerator. This is the atomic physics equivalent of a new accelerator. It will really make a big difference, and I'll tell you how. And it's almost ready. Phase 3 is an even much better new accelerator, and I'll tell you about that. So first of all, phase 1, we've made the interferometer a bit longer, so the spin is if you watch for longer, it processes through a bigger angle, so it's easier to see. That improves the sensitivity. We've got rid of some background, so in the end, that's what's happened to our sensitivity. It's 2.5 times better. We've completed all of the systematic tests. I don't want to go through them, but just to say systematic error is down below 10 to the minus 28, and we're making a measurement at the 2 times 10 to the minus 28 level now. Phase 2 is a new source. So this is a helium cell in a cryostat at about 3K, and there's a target here which has in it some ytterbium metal and some fluorine atoms. And we whack it with a laser, and a big plume of hot stuff comes out of this target. It's 20,000 degrees, and it's got all kinds of muck in it, including ytterbium atoms and fluorine atoms. They combine to make molecules, and there's all kinds of other stuff as well. And out comes a beam which contains YBF, and that's our beam. And what's good about it, I won't bother with this. It's just a spectrum for molecular people to admire. But what's good about it is, we get 10 more molecules per pulse, so the brightness of the beam's gone up, and it's 4 times slower, which means that the spin has 4 times longer to rotate, and that translates into more than an order of magnitude improvement in sensitivity. So we think that can get us to the 10 to the minus 29 e-centimeter range. And I'm pretty confident up to that point that we know what we're doing, and we can get there. Phase 3 is the big step into the unknown. But it's really exciting because it involves laser cooling molecules. So we're going to make a molecular fountain. The idea is that our YBF molecules, which normally are zooming along at hundreds of meters per second, we're going to make them so slow that we can throw them up in the air, well, in the vacuum, and they'll go up a little way and then turn around and come back down again. And you know how long it takes, right? I'll do it with this. How long does it take? Well, it's about a second. Half a second or something. Molecules work exactly the same way as this thing. So that's the plan, and it's all described in this paper. This source is under development. Molecules will come out of it and be guided off to the side to get out of the way of this helium gas that's been carrying them. This is a kind of wind, and we don't want them to be blown by the wind. So we get them into this quiet place. We shine some lasers on them to cool them, and then we throw them up, and we do the experiment, RF pulse, long spin precession time, RF pulse, interrogate with the lasers. And that's giving us seconds instead of milliseconds. And the bit that I've glossed over, the experts will know, is this, hang on, what about this laser cooling of the molecules? And that in itself is a whole topic, how to do that. But we've already been practicing, and we know we're able to laser cool calcium fluoride and strontium fluoride. So, and we understand how to do it for ytterbium fluoride. That's another talk. And what will it give us? Well, we calculate, we estimate as best we can, in less than a day, in 8 hours, we should get 6 × 10⁻³¹. So that's good. That's below the bottom of all the theories that I've shown you. There are, of course, dipole moment may not emerge anyway, but that's what we're trying. Yeah. Just to say, we're not the only people interested in this topic. There's just down the road from you, there's a Yale-Harvard collaboration. They're working with a molecular beam of thorium oxide in this triplet delta metastable state. It's all a rage now. There are these guys in Michigan want to work on the unfortunately named WC molecule, which is also a triplet delta. And then Eric Cornell's group in Colorado have an idea for a trapped ion experiment, and it's also a triplet delta. There's no time to tell you about the pros and cons of this triplet delta state. Ours is a doublet sigma state. It's a little different from systematic error point of view. There are also some experiments in preparation on atoms trapped in optical lattices, Dave Weiss and Dan Heinsohn, and this is unclear. This slide hasn't changed for about 4 years. So, I don't know. But they're working hard, and it's a serious effort. And then there's a terrifying experiment in Japan to trap francium atoms in a mott. So, you know, this is done in an accelerator building because it's a radioactive element and so on. So, and they think they may start in 2014. This is some of the more serious things going on in the same area. So there's a community of people trying to do this stuff. Current status is this. The first electron EDM measurement using the enhancement by atoms, which was indeed the first really sensitive one, was in 1963, nearly the 50th anniversary. And they got about 10⁻². And it's been coming down over time. These two here are YBF. That was our first proof of principle, and this was the measurement that I've just told you about. And, well, of course, you know what to do, right? We're physicists. We join the connector. So, but actually, I'm not kidding. I think we can do this. This is 10⁻³¹, and I think we can do it in the next 7 years. So maybe even slightly sooner. Who knows? Here's some theories. This is just taken from compilations of papers. So what theorists' best guesses are, and they're supposed to indicate probabilities. You'll see that although the neutron here is not quite as constrained as the electron, it's about a factor of 30, some theories, in any case, would give the neutron a bigger dipole moment. So we need to do both things, because the neutron is feeling strong interactions in a way that the electron doesn't. So it's important to probe the vacuum with both of these antennas. Here's just a list of some particles, electron, neutron, proton, and muon, and where the experimental limits are. So let me finish by saying that measuring the electric dipole moment of the electron is a direct probe of physics beyond the standard model. If we see it, if we see a non-zero dipole moment, it doesn't even matter whether the chemists have calculated the enhancement factor correctly. If we see a non-zero signal, that's a proof of physics beyond the standard model. Then, of course, we would worry a lot about getting the enhancement factor right, but that's a separate question. Specifically, what it probes is CP violation, which is interesting, not least because it has something to do with the question about how come we're here. And as I've shown you, we see a way to get down to the 10⁻³¹ level. And so if I just shamelessly exaggerate the situation. This is true. It's atto volt molecular spectroscopy, atto electron volt molecular spectroscopy, and it's telling us about tera electron volt particle physics. And the answer to my question is the electron is too round, so we're going to keep on looking. And finally, I have to say this has been a long, complicated, technically challenging project, and I have colleagues here who've worked. Ben Sauer worked with me from the beginning. He came as a postdoc, and his job was to find a molecule that might be okay for this experiment. And he's the guy who said to me, there's something called YBF we ought to have a look at. So he's now responsible for, let's start with Johnny. So Johnny is leading the measurement on the electric dipole moment. Mike Tarbert is developing the sources. And Ben is working on the on the laser cooling, we work together on everything as a group, but these are their specialties. And then these fine institutions have given us money. That's it.